seated. Mr. Shapiro, it's your turn.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are many things to respond to, so let me get started. And we had envisioned this along the way that the court had, and so I will address the legal issues and address some of the arguments that Mr. Sullivan made, but there may be some specifics if the court wants to hear them on the responses to some of the criticism, Mr. Cook's testimony, and what his response would be that Mr. Paikin will address, and of course Mr. Cook's here and hear from him, because let me just say that we have a very different view of the facts and the law. But let me start with what the court anticipated, which is Mr. Sullivan said very clearly, this is about fair rental value starts with fair market value. And fair market value is what would a willing lessee pay to a willing lessor with all the limitations and restrictions attended to it. And we know the answer to that. Because this very property is part of the overall deal that Vail did with Talisker. And as Mr. Sullivan has conceded, both in the brief and repeatedly today, $11.4 million of that, we can talk about that, but whether that's exactly $11.4 or it's a little less or a little more, was the value paid in a arm's length negotiation between willing participants who were setting, by definition, the fair market value for just that property with all of its attendant restrictions. It understates it.
Well, those parties didn't set the $11 million number. That was set after the fact by Mr. Cook, your expert. I mean, at least not that I'm aware of, there isn't any differentiation in the transaction documents that say, hey, we're paying this much for the PCMR resort lands and this much for canyons.
That's correct. These parties agreed on $25 million right. for both.
And some portion of that's the resort lands, and we're arguing today over what portion that is. Right.
And part of what I'm saying to you is Mr. Sullivan has repeatedly conceded that 11.4 is a perfectly fine estimate of that. But
I'm not sure that was what Mr. Sullivan's argument was. But
might overstate it.
We'll let that stand for itself.
Let me just say, in their brief, which is not susceptible to the sort of slip of the tongue or a misstatement, but I considered a statement they write, it is undisputed that Vail is paying Talisker more than $11 million per year as rent for the lease premises. That's a concession, as in my world, Your Honor, and I hope in yours. It's in writing. It's a considered response, and they use that argument repeatedly in their mitigation argument. They want to have it both ways here. It's thoroughly mitigated, it's $11 million, but actually it's nothing. It's $11 million. Again, is it 10, is it 12? You're right, we could talk about that.
But let's talk about the fact that you guys Vail in their 10Q or 10K, I never can get those letters straight, but they put a different value on it, didn't they?
No. But let me just finish one thought and then come to that. Because the 11.4 is not the valuation for that property. It is the discounted by the legal risk valuation for that property. Because at the time, in May of 2013, the court had not ruled on the possession issue. So obviously, It's a slightly different thing when you're buying something with a clouded title and an open litigation. You obviously are paying less for that than you would now. If we look at that property, let's say in 2011 the leases had just expired, or for that matter consider that we're in 2051, there is no claim. At that point, right, we're going to have a number of competing bidders for that property. One of them, frankly, because you have to assume economic the rational actors all around, will be JPCC. It'll be PCMR. Because everybody agrees that the highest, most valuable use for that property is to connect it with that base. And so presumably they will pay more than anyone for that. But that land is also contiguous with two other world-class ski areas, and it is, as we see from what Vail did in connection with canyons, worth a lot even there. It's worth a lot knowing that you might never get the base. It's worth a lot knowing that PCMR might take an economically irrational position out of emotion or spite and say, no, we're not gonna deal with you. And all of that was known at the time of that $11.4 million. Again, exactly 11.4 is an estimate, that's for sure. Now, is that, and the idea that the $12.5 million rent that Mr. Cook calculated for 2012 is out of the ballpark when it's barely more than the discounted contingent interest that Vail paid for, is a sort of self-refuting statement. It was said repeatedly that this is a large percentage of Mr. Cook's overall valuation at 22.8. That's just a misreading of Mr. Cook. He did not ever do a fair market value of the entire PCMR at 22.8. There's a stage along the way in which he does that. And in fact, Mr. Cumming testified under oath in these deposition, these proceedings, that the fair market value for the PCMR is somewhere between 10 and 12 times EBITDA. So the numbers are there in front of you. That's over $300 million. Now again, that's for all of it. They claim that the most valuable part of that is the base. They've been claiming that in this court repeatedly and in public, that that's where the value lies. But let's say only 25% of the value is on the base. That gets you to $75 or $80 million, not to $22. But let me come to your question about the 10K. The 10K, and Your Honor, put your finger on it. The 10K, which is conveniently in this binder Mr. Sullivan handed up at tab 5, it says two things. It values the transaction in two pieces. And again, let's remember, for all of this, it's discounted by the legal risk. Right? What they're paying for is discounted by the legal risk that this court or an appellate court would rule, no, PCMR is entitled to stay on that land. So $57.8 million as a deposit for the land, and then goodwill. And this part is not highlighted, perhaps not surprisingly, in the version Mr. Sullivan handed up to you. It says the excess of the aggregate fair value of assets acquired and liabilities assumed was recorded as goodwill. That's another $77 million. And the next sentence, I'm reading from F-19. The goodwill recognized is attributed primarily to expected synergies, including the potential inclusion of the ski terrain of Park City Mountain Resort in the lease. So valuing it looking ahead is a substantial portion, primary portion of that $77 million on top of the 57. And how do you know that? Because you also know by the documents they helpfully submitted that Mr. Katz had offered $100 million outright for the property. That's in the email between Mr. Katz and Mr. Bistricer that was attached at tab J of their initial brief. So their sense of value, as reflected here, gets you north of $100 million when you count all of this. And by the way, the court was again right, the 10K says what the discount rate is for the 10K. You don't get to pick the numbers from the 10K and then use somebody else's sense of a discount rate. On the top of page F-19, same page, and elsewhere, by the way, page F-17 also, they were using a 10% discount rate for Vail. So once you get 57.8 plus any meaningful portion of that $77 million in goodwill, and you apply a 10% discount rate, you're again very close to the $9, $10, $11 million a year. Doesn't get you to 5.7. That is the open market transaction between arm's length parties that is what establishes, is what defines fair market value. All the rest of it, all of what their experts did, all of what our experts did, are approximations, attempts to get at a number like that through calculation to derive one. But here we actually have one. Now we need to scale it up because, again, there's a litigation discount. We need to appreciate that there are other aspects to this. But it doesn't get you down to numbers.
What about Mr. Sullivan's contention that Vail admitted this was an above-market transaction?
I don't know where he gets that. It says that nowhere in this 10-K that I'm aware of. I believe Mr. Sullivan has innocently confused what's said about the North Star lease, in which it does say that. It does not say that about this. This establishes the market. It does treat it as a capital lease, but that's, of course, an accounting convention that just says there's a transfer of value over an extended period of time. That's a rule of GAAP. It's not a legal rule, and it doesn't by itself speak to being above market. So this is really where this has to start and where it has to end. There is a transaction here between unrelated parties at arm's length for a discounted contingent interest in this property that adds up at $11 million. The idea that the fair market value for this, that the appropriate rent is less than what was actually being paid, is truly absurd, particularly when there's repeated acknowledgments by PCMR that their previous lease was below market. Not that anyone could have disputed that. The idea that 3,000 acres of prime ski terrain in Park City, contiguous to the PCMR base and contiguous to Deer Valley and to canyons, is to be valued by looking at 3,000 acres of ranch land somewhere across the state is absurd. No one, I'd be shocked if anyone you stopped on the street here would think that. $226,000 a year in rent, even at their discount rate, translates into $4.5 million in overall value. There are, I've been told, I'm not from around here, but that when I've been on these ski lifts, that some of the houses you look at go for more than that. I mean, that's crazy talk. So let's get back to, there are ships passing in the night, but that's because they want to come out with a low number. I understand that. And they've done, you know, their best efforts to get there. But you can't get there by ignoring the transaction on this property that got it at a discounted contingent value at $11 million. Forest Service numbers are not market. Regardless of what the United States Congress wrote in some statute, and as the court pointed out, that includes the, you know, properties in New Jersey and Minnesota, as well as those in Utah and Colorado. But in any event, that's why when they purchased Copper Mountain, they needed to add to their books additional value that exceeded the amount being asked for in rent here. So we're talking about a willing buyer and a willing seller. And of course, the fact that the property is unique and uniquely situated and is capable of being used to generate vast sums of money as they have been using it increases its value. I mean, that's such an elementary...
Well, it increases its value to them.
It increases, yes.
I mean, the question I asked him about the income approach, do you agree with Mike, where I was at there, that the income approach is best used looking at a generic owner of the property rather than at one particular owner of the property?
Well, so their own, their, again, if we're at 2011 and the leases had expired, or 2051, they are one of the willing buyers. Right? Someone holding that property, whether it's them or somebody else, is somebody in the market.
Right, but we wouldn't be where we are today if they were willing to make an offer that you were willing to accept. So obviously they haven't offered $11 million. Vail came in and did. My question is, when you look at the property in terms of a generic user, any other generic user other than them is going to have substantial costs associated with making money on that property.
Some costs, to be sure. Some costs, those costs are less for Canyons and Deer Valley than for some other third party.
That's right.
But there are some costs. And that cost is factored into the $11.4 million discounted contingent interest. Right? It's not like Vail didn't know that. It was perfectly apparent.
Right. And so that now we're back to comparable sale method. I mean, you're saying, well, the best way to value this property is what somebody paid for it in 2013. I understand your point there. But if you're going to go outside the comparable sale method to an income-based method, we have to look at generic users, not just them. Right?
Not just them. I agree with that. I don't think you exclude them because they happen to have before misplayed the negotiations and not agreed to do something which they're now left without a schema. I don't think that means they come out of it, but I agree, it's not limited to them. That's absolutely right. You know, the restatement is in the binder that Mr. Sullivan provided. It's at tab 13. And there's a part that he did not highlight. Right, the basic sentence is, as he fairly read, the landlord is entitled to recover from a tenant improperly holding over at a rate based on the previous rental rate or the proven reasonable value independently established if that differs from the previous rental rate. Now, if you go to the reporter's notes on the third page of this, it has an entry justification for the general rule, not highlighted in what was handed up to the court. The rule of this section provides a standard restitution remedy. Since it lies outside any agreement by the parties, it's not limited by the terms. It simply requires the tenant to pay for what he got during the holdover period. That's the restatement principle. Pay for what he got. What was the value they were able to get out of the use of Talisker's land? Now, nowhere in here, and Mr. Paikin or for that matter, Mr. Cook himself can elaborate on this, but nowhere on, this is not asking for a disgorgement of all profits. Although let me just note again, Mr. Sullivan is eager to talk about how outrageous these numbers are. There, just a few weeks ago, their expert said that if they are not allowed to have the upper terrain, they would lose $16 million in profits. Now, how is it how somehow an amount less than that leaves them, they say, with nothing when their own expert, calculating that 77% of the revenue comes out from the Talisker terrain, that they would lose $16 million in profit in 1 year? The number then decreases over time because he is asked to assume that already in the second year they're able to reopen half the lifts, and in the third year they reopen all the lifts and they build back the business. So they got to a total of under $40 million over 5 years, but the year when they're actually without that, $16 million in profits. That's what their expert says this terrain is worth to them. We're not asking for that. In all of the calculations, there was a management fee allowed to be recovered for that. There's CapEx to continue it up. It's not seeking to extract all profits from this. But it is a measure of the value of this property. in the way that Forrester and others talk about. It's reasonable value of use and occupancy is what they have done with it. It's not like their law firm, for whom one building, as nice as the views are, what they're selling is not the views. They're selling their legal services. And if they had to move to a different office, they'd still be selling legal services.
No, they have views of Temple Square, so, you know, that might count for something in this time.
And I dare say they pay more for views of Temple Square than for six blocks further away.
Fair enough.
So that part is incorporated into the rental value, but their legal services are not. What PCMR is selling is the ski experience on those 3,000 acres. So it's a very, very different situation. It is an obvious fact that some property is worth more by virtue of its location, by its proximity, by its scarcity. This is an extraordinarily scarce asset. I certainly don't need to tell the court that. Having skiable terrain like that adjacent to Park City within 45 minutes of a major international airport, it's just not out there for the taking. It's not 3,000 acres of farmland. The immediately contiguous property, the PPI lease, just so happens to rent at a level that if you scale that up to those 3,000 acres, you'd also come out with 11.4. Could be just a coincidence, but it suggests that we're somewhere around. Now, that is a low number, no doubt, because it's not an arm's length deal. It's a related party transactions, which typically are for less than the arm's length deal, not for more. Way back in 1975, when there was barely a ski industry there, the rental value for that property, for that PPI piece of property, if scaled up for the whole, would be more than $7 million. In 1975, when the economic value was both less and far less apparent than now. So the idea that we should be talking about numbers like $1 or $2 or $3 million just blinks reality. The ASC lease at Canyons was a 17-year-old lease for a what was described as an undeveloped property, a ski area, with no more than 100,000 skier visits a year, and with a huge upfront payment on the side. So that's not comparable. So what's being asked for here is much less than 25% of PCMR's revenues. It's not more or half of its total fair market value. It was not, again, this can, Mr. Paikin can address this, $22.8 million was not Mr. Cook's appraisal of fair market value, which is well in excess of $100 million. And as I said, Mr. Cumming himself, who presumably has some sense of this, testified that it would be 10 or 12 times EBITDA. You've got those EBITDA numbers in Cook's declaration, but we get way up there. For the whole property, to be sure. But again, what's their argument? That the base is only worth 10%? Certainly haven't been hearing that from them, either in this court or out. So let me address a couple of the other legal issues, and then if it's useful to the court, let Mr. Paikin address some of the specific issues about Mr. Cook's analysis. Mitigation. I guess I can't tell if GPCC is just consistently misreading the assignment of rents, but let me make this clear. Let's look, it's at tab 4. They've even highlighted this. Part of what goes to Vail in exchange for the $11.4 million of contingent interest, discounted contingent interest, is, in the now therefore paragraph, does hereby irrevocably, absolutely, and unconditionally transfer, sale, assign, and convey to S&E. And then you have one paragraph, operative paragraph, all deposits. Halfway down that, I believe it's seven lines down that, together with the proceeds of all claims of any kind that Asinor, Talisker, may have against any tenant, lessee, or licensee under the leases, GPCC. So there's no dispute that that is part of the assignment of rents. There's no double recovery here by Talisker. Now, it's not an assignment of the claim. It's an assignment of the proceeds. That's why there's not a real party of interest problem. It is fairly common, Utah Supreme Court has recognized it as such statutes, to sell proceeds of possible claims in exchange for something. That doesn't undermine or disrupt the claim itself. So first of all, there's no double collection. Second of all, and it is right, Mr. Sullivan predicted I would say this, and I will, until Vail gets possession of that property, what it's paying is not rent. It can't be. Now, it will continue on after, so it's a fair estimation of what the rent will be, to be sure. But they're not paying rent right now. You don't pay rent for something you don't possess, which is a point they make on page 28 of their brief. Again, a concession that until these matters are finally resolved and GPCC vacates that property and it's added to the master lease, Vail does not possess it. But on the legal point, the very same argument, this is a little bit reminiscent about what we had earlier in this case, were very same arguments that were rejected by the Utah Supreme Court get made in this courtroom over again. In the Mahana case, the collateral source rule was held to apply over the objection that it's really just for insurance contracts. That argument was made. This is for insurance contracts, and the court said the rule is not limited to insurance contracts. It is applicable unless the collateral recovery comes from the defendant or a person acting on his behalf, and that's certainly not the case. So there is no mitigation here. And I do agree that the court needs to decide this matter because their claim, which the audacity of which really is what's most noticeable, is that they owe zero rent from May 1, 2013 forward. That they're permitted to remain on that property, to continue to reap vast profits, to continue to transfer those through intercompany transfers upstream to Powder. Again, they say it's common for companies like this to pool cash at a parent level. Well, it may be common, and there's nothing inherently wrong with it, but it does put it beyond our reach in payment for damages. And that is what this bond has to secure. So there's no legitimate mitigation claim here at all. And by the way, Mahano also says, even if there was double recovery, we prefer a windfall goes to the innocent victim than to the wrongdoer. They have overstayed their lease by now 3+ years. They are the wrongdoer here. There's no mitigation argument. The unlawful detainer statute is mandatory about Treblin. It is right that the court won't ultimately award damages until we get to the very end. But at this stage, the court respectfully needs to estimate what those damages will be. And to to ensure that at the end of this process, Talisker is not left holding an empty bag. That's what a bond is for, right? I mean, that's the Utah Supreme Court in Diversified Holdings says it bond protects a judgment by providing a surety to whom the creditor may look should the appeal fail and the judgment debtor's financial position so deteriorate between judgment and disposition of the appeal that payment of the judgment by the debtor becomes impossible.
Well, that's true of an appeal bond when you have a judgment, but you don't have a judgment.
But we do have an appeal.
But you don't have a money judgment. I mean, in other words, my point to Mr. Sullivan right there at the end was even if I say, look, I'm not going to even grant a stay, so I'm not going to consider a bond, you go ahead and go evict. You couldn't go collect. You couldn't go levy on their assets at that point. All you could do is go evict them.
But
you don't have a money judgment. In other words, why the question I want you to answer is why should this bond address collectability of the ultimate judgment, and why shouldn't it just address the damages or the harm imposed by the stay?
Because the only basis on which we consented to a stay was the fact that they had filed an appeal.
Okay, but we're a little outside the realm of what you consented to, right? I mean, I get to make the decision here, even if you don't consent to it.
Fair enough, Your Honor, but respectfully, the court doesn't have the authority to grant a stay here under the unlawful detainer statute, except for a very short period of time until the enforcement hearing is held, which is supposed to be held within 10 days. The unlawful detainer statute says if a proceeding is for unlawful detainer, execution upon the judgment shall be issued immediately after the entry of the judgment. You have made the judgment that they're an unlawful detainer. You haven't awarded the damages. There is no basis for a stay here other than for a short period of time. So if that's...
Short's in the eye of the beholder, I suppose.
It no doubt is. Utah Supreme Court says it can't be indefinite. The court does not have the power to do that. Our consent or otherwise notwithstanding, as you say. Short, I dare say, submit to you, Your Honor, is not April 30th of next year. Short time, as envisioned by the unlawful detainer statute, is for the enforcement hearing to be done and concluded.
Right, but most eviction cases, most unlawful detainer cases are a lot simpler than this one. And you get from immediate occupancy hearing to final judgment on money damages in a very short period of time. Thereby, you can put the stay in place to preserve whatever rights the tenant might have to appeal the eviction. And then the tenant goes and appeals the eviction, you put a bigger bond in place and you go. In this case, where we have other issues going on, what's the mechanism to preserve their appeal rights upon bond, if not that statute?
The mechanism is 62C.
Well, 62C doesn't apply until we have final judgment.
You are staying an they are appealing from an injunctive order that is being stayed. That order, the court has already found that, already ruled they're an unlawful detainer. And it says that the court, I don't have the language directly in front of me, but basically needs to secure, here it is, upon such conditions as considers property for the security of the rights of the adverse party. Our security, then, what needs to be secured here is not just our getting back our property, but are collecting the damages.
And I agree with you that that needs to be secured after you have a judgment for it. But if you don't have the right to collect on it now, I'm really having a hard time seeing why they need to bond against it now. I mean, why should they bond against collectability if you can't collect?
Well, that's why the court is in a position of estimating. They bond against it because the court, having made the decision that they're an unlawful detainer, the question, all that remains is to determine the damages. And there's no question that those are and will be due and owing to Talisker. And to delay our ability...
But I'm not delaying your... No stay would be delaying your ability to collect on that money. There, nothing in this case is even asked to be stayed other than the eviction, right? The rest of the case is going forward apace. You're still doing expert discovery. We may discuss at the end of this hearing potentially where you are on trial dates. Nothing outside the scope of this eviction is being stayed. In other words, there isn't anything harming you or hindering you from proceeding to collection on your money judgment. And so if there's nothing in, your way there, why should they have to bond against that?
Because the unlawful detainer statute itself, the possession bond, says the court shall approve the bond. This is a possession bond now. And that presumably is what the court is talking about imposing. Shall approve a bond in an amount which is the probable amount of costs of suit, including attorney's fees, and actual damages, which may result, right? So it's not assuming it's already been adjudicated, which may result to the plaintiff if the defendant has improperly withheld possession. That would be what applies even at the beginning of this process, before the court had ruled that they were an unlawful detainer. Now, we're 2/3 of the way down that road. And just for clarity, I'm reading from 78B-6-808, 4B-6. Again, the court shall approve the bond in an amount which is the probable amount of cost of suit, including attorney's fees, and actual damages which may result to the plaintiff if the defendant has improperly withheld possession. Well, you've already found that they have. And the actual damages are the fair rental value from April 1, 2011 until the end of this stay. And that part, I think, is frankly, Your Honor, beyond dispute. I understand that there's then a question. Do actual damages include the treble damages for the part from 5 days after the notice to vacate in August 28th of 2013? I would submit to you that the better argument is that it does, because that's what the actual damages will be. It doesn't say compensatory damages. The actual damages here are the fair rental value for May 1, 2011 through April 30th, 2012. The fair rental value from April 1, 2012 through April 30th, 2013. The fair rental value from May 1, 2013 until I think the date is September 2nd or 3rd, 5 days after that August 28th notice to quit, and trebling from that point forward. Those are the actual damages. And a possession bond under the unlawful detainer statute, even if they're only ones that may result if the defendant has improperly withheld possession. Here we know that damages do result and that the defendant has improperly withheld possession. So that's the basis, Your Honor. And I take your point that we're not being stopped from collecting because we don't yet have something to collect. But that is envisioned here by the possession bond in the unlawful detainer statute. They need to post a bond that covers our actual damages. And those damages, running from April 1, 2011 through April 1, 2015, if that's the period of time, April 30th, 2015, are quite substantial. You've seen from our calculation that there are $124 million. That includes 5 full years of rent and the trebling for the last year and or in two-thirds of that. And it includes, so let me come back to these legal arguments. It certainly includes prejudgment interest. Here again, Smith versus Fairfax is the relevant Utah Supreme Court case here, and it says not only for liquidated damages, it's for any damages the time period of which is fixed in time, and we know precisely what period is fixed in time here. That's why I just tediously, no doubt, and I apologize, noted the time periods for each of those of the lease terms, or what would have been the lease terms, and is calculable. Smith v. Fairfax says the fact that there's a dispute over it is not a reason not to apply prejudgment interest. So prejudgment interest is included.
What's the rate? What do you make of Mr. Sullivan's argument that the statute doesn't provide the rate?
I had to say that that was, my understanding is that the statute does provide the rate, but I haven't been able to go back and, I thought the statute specifies 10%.
It says it's 10% for the loan or forbearance of any money, goods, or chosen action. So your argument would be this is a case involving a forbearance of money?
Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't actually understand the argument to the contrary from that sentence. So I do think the rate is 10%. As to attorney's fees, again, there's no dispute that they're included. Virtually all of this case has been about possession. They argue to the court on the ROFR and right of first refusal and prohibition on sale that it was all inextricably intertwined and had to be dealt with simultaneously. The court could maybe come out another way on that. And to be fair, we argued it wasn't, although the court did grant them relief of handling that all together. Virtually all of the attorney's fees are deal with, as Golden Meadow said, related legal theories on a common core of facts. The fact that there were a couple other claims brought and dismissed early, before my law firm was involved, so none of those fees are affected by that, it's possibly a basis to shave a little bit off that number. And again, this is an estimation process. As the court noted quite correctly, we'll have time to do this all to the third decimal point. You know, we're not going to get there today. But the whole structure of the unlawful detainer statute is to create economic incentives to leave the premises when you're detaining them illegally. That's what the treble damages are about, which is frankly different than punitive damages, and I'm sure the court is far more familiar than I, but my understanding in Utah is after the first 50,000 punitive damages, any amount above that gets split between the state and the individual. It's treated very differently. That's not the case here. That statute does not apply to unlawful treble damages, so they're not punitive damages. So, when you, let me go back to where I started. There are lots of arguments that can be made about every effort by one expert or another to calculate precisely, and all of those were estimates done in a shortened period of time. We didn't even have normal expert discovery, right? People didn't have access to all documents, but they did the best they could. To be picked apart by lawyers on both sides, to be sure. But one thing is consistent. The numbers that Mr. Cook calculated through his various approaches, which range, you know, from $10 to $14 million, surround a heartland, which we know to be the case, which is the actual market value that was set in a arm's length transaction between Vail and Talisker for a less valuable asset, which is to say the same property clouded by a legal dispute which had not yet been resolved, and which to this day hasn't been finally resolved. But it's obviously less cluttered today than it was then. If it is useful to the court, I know Mr. Paikin would be happy to address some of the specific criticisms of Mr. Cook's methodology, and it might make sense to do that because we heard a lot about that from Mr. Sullivan.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just focus on the criticisms. Your Honor already has the declaration. I'm not going to walk through precisely what he did, but I'm going to focus in on the specific criticisms that have been lodged against Mr. Cook. And by virtue of the way this played out, we haven't had an opportunity to respond to those in writing. So this is by way of addressing those criticisms and a proffer as to what Mr. Cook would say in the event that he's crossed, what he would say as well under cross. So the criticisms essentially really break down into three areas. The first is this issue of whether you look at it with respect to use value or market value. And that takes different forms, sometimes saying that whether you should value it for its highest and best use as ranch land or as as part of an integrated ski resort. And it gets at the issue of whether or not you value the asset, including within that some component of the business. So that's the first set of issues. The second set of issues are allegations that his amount is unreasonable, because if PCMR was to pay that amount, the resort would not be profitable. And that's the second set of issues, and I want to address those. And the third is this sort of notion that Mr. Cook's analysis leads to absurd results. And it's a little bit of a catch-all, but they say that the rate of return is unreasonable, that this amount of rent is different than the way that he valued the property, and those sorts of allegations. And I want to address those. And I'm going to take each of those three things in turn. And let me start with this issue of the use value versus the market value. And let me make perfectly clear that what Mr. Cook is doing is he's determining what the market value of that property would be. And in the course of doing that, in determining market value, you look at the income, you look at comparables, and there's also the cost approach. That's not something different. That's not use value. And let me walk through it. But what we're trying to get at here is what is the market value? And the question is, what would happen? Let's take in 2051, this property is back out on the market, and you've got willing and rational buyers all around. And what would happen is there would be significant interest from PCMR, and we're assuming a willing and rational buyer here. You'd have significant interest from PCMR, you'd have significant interest from Deer Valley, and you'd have significant interest from Canyons. You'd also have interest from other investors who might be interested in possibly flipping that property and trying to get an arrangement with one of those parties. Now, their risk would be higher for the investors, and so their cap rates and rates of returns would probably be higher than the 10% that Vail used in its transaction. But that's who would be interested. This property would be out on the market. There are buyers for it. We've seen that from the Vail transaction. So what is the highest and best use of this property? It's as for its assemblage value. On its own, the property, people wouldn't use it for that purpose. You would use it as part of an assemblage with one of the neighboring ski resorts. And the market would recognize that. That's what Canyons would pay for it. That's what PCMR should pay for it. And that's what Deer Valley should pay for it. It has value to them on the market by virtue of the fact that it's a unique piece of property that sits between them. And there's not a whole lot of ski terrain. I don't think in the last 20, 30 years there's been another ski mountain that's been created in the United States. Might be wrong about that, but that's my understanding. This is very rare property, and it's right there, and it's central to their business. Now, the market would consider how much money this land could generate. Somebody's going to take that into account in deciding how much they're going to pay for.
Right, that's the income approach. They would consider how much money it would make to not just to them, but to a generic user.
That's exactly right. But it's not a generic user, because what would the market be? It would be how much money could Canyons make from the property? How much money could Deer Valley make from the property? How much money could PCMR make from the property? How much money would an investor that would invest in this be able to make from the property if he was to rent it out to one of those three parties?
Right, but market value can't be what it's worth to this investor versus what it's worth to Deer Valley versus what it's worth to PCMR. I mean, generally, we don't look at what a property is worth to a particular buyer, do we? We look at what the property is worth on the market.